Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And today's show is going to be very interesting and unusual, a subject that once nearly took my whole life for about 5 years, and then a bit more for a few more years. It's the subject of lobotomy and psychosurgery, and it's the subject of the newfangled approaches, deep brain stimulation, the surgical intervention, the electronic intervention into the brains of human beings to remedy what I believe have nothing to do with the brain, spiritual, psychological, social issues, all the things human beings struggle with and have always struggled with in this difficult passage on earth that we all go through. My guest is Danielle Egan. Are you there, Danielle? Hi. Let me introduce you. And Danielle suggested, which was very kind, that I actually introduce the subject by going back to my own work, which I'll do for about 5 or 6 minutes, perhaps. And then we'll have the whole hour with Danielle. Danielle is a Vancouver-based freelance journalist. I first got to know her in the mid-1990s when she was working on articles on psychosurgery in Canada. She did very in-depth, painstaking, revealing examinations of what was going on and interviewed people and brought it to life through the patients and the doctors alike. And she's written those articles for Canadian magazines. She's also written about the whole potential of future biomedical technologies. So she's right on the cutting edge, and she's published in New Scientist, the San Francisco Chronicle. I got started in the whole psychosurgery controversy when I was just a year or two out of my training and my stay as at the National Institute of Mental Health, which I did after my psychiatric training. I was there for 2 years. I set up a private practice because I realized at that point that there really wasn't going to be a place for me, as I had hoped, in the middle of psychiatry, that I wouldn't be able to lead from within because it was too corrupt from within. And I thought I'd just write books, do research. I was working on some novels that got published, and that I would just mind my own business, really. And then I found out by reading a psychiatric newspaper that came across my way that there'd been an international meeting of the good old-fashioned lobotomists in 1972. I was so appalled by this. I knew that lobotomy had not been stopped on principle, but simply on practicality. The new antipsychotic drugs, starting with Thorazine, performed lobotomies quite more efficiently. You could titrate them, and you could put them into effect with little effort. And so that the lobotomy really didn't have a big place anymore in the hospital system. So I wrote to all the men and a couple of women who were involved in these projects that were listed in the newspaper. I was a young man then. Nobody knew about me. And they all wrote back enthusiastically telling me about their projects. And I began to see that there were hundreds of operations going on around the world, everywhere, Japan, India, Thailand, throughout Europe, North America, Canada, U.S. And I ended up taking 5 years, really, almost out of my life. I mean, there was a time when my practice had really dwindled to stop this. I worked with congressmen. I wrote the legislation for and set up the Psychosurgery Commission, which ended up, while being a failure by my standards actually put a huge crimp in the psychosurgeons because it declared the treatment experimental. I testified in the famous Kamowitz case as their key expert, which was a lobotomy, newfangled lobotomy with electrodes in Detroit, where I also met Ginger, and for the first time. And that trial was very successful. The state was highly criticized for operating on state mental hospital patients, and the particular patient was released from custody by the court. And that stopped psychosurgery pretty much in the VA and the state hospitals, government agencies. No one appealed that local case because they were afraid of making even a greater precedent, carrying it up to the Supreme Court. I fought to get Ted Kennedy to do hearings. Ted was very much opposed to my work. And when he finally decided to hold hearings and exclude me, I threatened to... I was pretty mean in those days, a little tougher than I am now, maybe. No, I wasn't. I'm still tough. But I sent word through Jackie Anderson, who was the biggest columnist at the time, that if Ted didn't invite me to the hearings, I was going to blow the whistle that they had lobotomized Rosemary because somebody had sent me a brown package with pictures of her and snippets of her records. And this was before this was at all known. So I was really, really fighting hard. I wrote articles. I talked to people at NIMH. And on a few occasions, some of the top people in the field of psychosurgery who thought they would just humiliate me, debated me, the head of the Mass General Department of Neurosurgery. And, well, you know, I have been gifted with the ability to talk, but I also did a lot of scientific research. I actually knew more about psychosurgery than the head of the department at Harvard. And that was quite humiliating for them. I just did everything I could. I was the first expert to ever go in a lawsuit against Walter Freeman, who performed at least 5,000 lobotomies in America. But he died during the same time period, and we couldn't continue. I was involved in many other cases against Ballantyne, several against Ballantyne, big Harvard surgeon. We didn't win them, but the cost of the surgery, of the cases, they took his insurance away, is my understanding, and he couldn't operate. I was making enemies and having successes left and right. Down in Mississippi, a fellow named O.J. Andy was operating on little black children in a segregated institution. Some of the kids were aged 5. Nobody protested. No one who read his articles about this protested. And they were walking around the wards with multiple electrodes hanging out of their heads, barely above toddler-age children. But I did, when I called the Department of Psychiatry chairman down at the University of Mississippi in Jackson, he said he'd not heard about this, and he actually was incensed. I was one of the few helping hands to stop this from within the profession. They set up a research committee, and Andy, O.J. Andy, he died sometime later. He couldn't meet standards for their research protocols. I could just go on and on and on and on. It was a frightening and scary time. I got heavily attacked, the usual life threats, the whole works. So that was the cutting edge for me. And by the time I was done, I had organized this huge movement of the Black Caucus in Congress who were concerned about, that's in the U.S. House of Representatives, concerned about these operations on children, about Harvard psychiatrists saying they'd like to operate on the leaders of black riots because they had to have something wrong with their brains. So I had a lot of support from them. I had a lot of support from feminists who were concerned about the disproportionate number of women. And I had support from actually the most effective support in some ways from conservatives in the Senate who thought it was immoral to operate on people's brains to change their mental processes and behavior. And out of this, I became a reformer. I became the person I am today. I don't do those massive projects anymore. I think that's just a matter of age. I'd rather write and talk than go traipsing around Congress. But it was an extremely successful campaign. And most of the psychosurgery in the Western world was stopped, but not all of it, as we'll hear today. And so that's my introduction. Now we're going to hand it over to Chris. I did that in about 9 minutes, 8 minutes, to Danielle, who Danielle Egan, E-G-A-N, the Vancouver freelance journalist, to talk about her experience from any direction she wants, because she's really up to date, finally, on the deep brain stimulation. Hi, Danielle.
Hi. That was a great preview, and I found out about psychiatric neurosurgeries, the resurgence of them, it was 2004, and I happened to read a University of British Columbia magazine article that had mentioned a doctor was talking about doing limbic surgeries. And one of his quotes said something along the lines of that psychiatry was rediscovering its biological roots. And so he didn't actually mention psychosurgery or lobotomy. He called it limbic surgery. But it sounded to me, the way he described it, as a psychosurgery. So I did an article about that and found out that this surgery was being done at a handful of medical specialty clinics, usually at university campuses. So Harvard, I believe the Cleveland Clinic, a couple of places in Europe, and at UBC and in Toronto as well. It wasn't just happening in specialty centers. It was happening as a one-off procedure because it's not considered an experimental surgery. So it could be happening at any hospital all around the globe. And eventually I was able to speak with a few patients who were considered responders. They were considered, say, the psychiatrist I spoke with actually put me in touch with the people saying that, yes, they'd had benefit from the surgery. But when I actually interviewed the people, I found that they had a lot of cognitive issues. And that led me down the path towards DBS. So a lot of these centers that were doing the psychiatric neurosurgeries, which are called things like cingulotomy, capsulotomy, hypothalamotomy, based on the parts of the brains that they were lesioning, were saying, these doctors are saying, well, we're starting to do this deep brain stimulation, and we're doing fewer of the psychosurgeries. So basically that led me to my next set of articles on deep brain stimulation.
Well, tell folks what the deep brain stimulation is.
So deep brain stimulation is like a psychosurgery. So basically two holes are drilled through the skull and up around the forehead area, just above the hairline. So on each side of the brain, two holes are drilled through the skull, and then the surgeon wires the deep brain stimulation device into the brain to the targeted location. And the targeted locations depend in part on the type of treatment. So if it's for depression, there are five different places in the brain being targeted. If it's for OCD, it's another part of the brain. With the movement disorders like Parkinson's and essential tremor, it's the movement centers of the brain. So depending on which disorder they're treating, they'll go into that part of the brain, and they'll lay this deep brain stimulator across that little part of the brain. And the deep brain stimulator has four, they're called contacts, and each of those contacts can be programmed to send out chronic voltage. So anywhere from 1 volt to up to 10 volts of electricity that can be programmed to chronically stimulate the brain. So the device, and it's remote control stimulation, so the wiring is actually goes from the part of the brain being targeted all the way around the back of the ear to a chest pacemaker that controls the electrical stimulation. And that electrical stimulation is controlled by a remote control programming device, basically a clicker that you can program to set the voltage parameters for the device. And the theory, they still don't really know why, what the mechanisms of DBS are, whether it's inhibiting brain function, which is the sort of the protocol for the psychosurgeries, is that you inhibit a part of the brain, you inhibit the neural pathways from communicating. And the original proposal was that DBS would inhibit those parts of the brain. But now they're starting to think that maybe it excites certain parts of the brain, and that provides the therapeutic benefit.
Do you know, Danielle, what the milliamps are that are coming out, being used for this, the current level? You mentioned the voltage.
Yeah, it's anywhere from 1 to 10. And milliamps, yeah. And that can actually targets the specific tissue that the electrodes are laid upon, but it also can stimulate tissue up to 6 millimeters away. So it really depends on what they'll typically do once the DBS device is in. They have to give the patient 2 weeks for their brain to just the swelling to go down and all of the sort of the potential for hemorrhage and stroke and all of that kind of stuff, and then they turn the device on, and then they titrate it to ideally provide a therapeutic benefit. So they typically say they'll start at lower voltages, and then if there isn't a therapeutic benefit, they'll increase the dosages, the voltages. But there's a little dispute about that because some of the quote-unquote successful trials that have had patients respond have been at quite high voltages. So the fear is that those high voltages could cause damage to the tissue around that part of the brain. So there are a lot of ethical issues, obviously, around this, a lot of safety issues. And so far, most of the trial data has found that people tend to benefit early on from the procedure, but it's in much the same way that people typically benefited from the psychosurgeries, in that they have sort of a post-surgery stun effect. So they have cognitive blunting to a degree, just because you're going into the brain and the surgery itself, the drilling through the skull, can really impact the brain and cause all sorts of swelling. So that will cause immediate sort of, you know, from the 70s, what they called, I think they called it euphoria.
Well, yeah, it is technically a euphoria, brain damage, euphoria from brain damage.
Yeah, and then typically the brain will heal itself. I mean, one of the things that studying this, doing this research, one of the things that always amazes me is how the ability of the brain to recover from these kind of dramatic invasive procedures. And typically with DBS, you'll see that as well. So a lot of the responder rates early on in these clinical trials are a result of that. But this is where the floodgates will open, because for whatever reason, this DBS is so tantalizing to reporters, to the media, that we've, for whatever reason, we're able to write about these procedures at an experimental level when maybe a handful of people have actually had the procedure. And that's exactly what happened with DBS around 2005. There was a big New York Times article about it. And part of the reason is because, you know, there's so much criticism about psychiatric drugs not working. So you have so many more so-called treatment-resistant people who need treatments. You could argue because they've been damaged by the drugs, or you could say that because the drugs didn't work. So you have more and more people falling into this treatment-resistant label, and these people have very real-life issues with getting psychiatric care or any sort of medical care to deal with their depression, their anxiety, their OCD, and they're more and more desperate to try these last-resort treatments. So, for example, when Dr. Helen Mayberg started doing the procedure, Dr. Mayberg and Dr. Lozano, the neurosurgeon, started to do this procedure in Toronto, they had hundreds of people wanting this procedure done, and they could only have a handful actually go through the clinical trial. So it speaks a lot to the desperation of these people. And typically, initially, the first people they would kind of hold out as responders to the treatment were in that early six-month phase. So it's really dangerous to extrapolate that into down the road, how these people are going to react and respond to it. And also, typically, the significant majority of people actually didn't respond and had very serious adverse effects. But as a reporter, how do you find these people when the doctors, these people are anonymous, and the doctors aren't necessarily going to give you the phone numbers of people who aren't responding to the treatment? So I ran across quite a few roadblocks right from the get-go in 2006 of I really wanted to speak with patients, and I just couldn't get in touch with them. I wasn't able to. So it wasn't actually until this year that I was able to finally speak with recipients. And, you know, I keep calling them patients, but these are citizens, and they're recipients of the procedure. So to look at them as unique individuals and to hear them give a voice to their stories was really important to me because, you know, when you read the clinical trial studies, you hear about responders and non-responders, and you get little hints of details or hints of information about them, but you don't really get a full picture of their experiences. And this was really able to give me a better picture of what some of these people had experienced. And in this case, I focused on three people who'd been participants in something called the Broaden trial, which was a trial of deep brain stimulation for depression.
Did you get those three people, Danielle?
Well, I actually initially spoke with a gentleman who had started a blog. He was part of the Broaden trial, and he'd started a blog. He was very careful not to give the public information about whether he was a responder or a non-responder, but he provided a sort of an opening for people to get in touch with him. And that also allowed other patients. This was a multi-center trial, so it allowed other patients from other parts of the U.S. to speak to each other. And they formed a private Facebook group. And so through Dan, I was able to, he put a post on his private Facebook group, and people started calling me. And unfortunately, they were all non-responders. They think there's about 15 people in this group. And out of the total of 15, maybe one could be considered a responder, but if you look at the actual clinical trial data, well, there is no clinical trial data yet. That's yet to be published. But the Broaden sponsors, the device manufacturer that created the DBS device that sponsored the trial, they terminated the trial based on a futility analysis, and that analysis found that only about 18% or so might benefit from this procedure. And the Broaden trial was going to be a really big trial. Ultimately, 128 patients were given the DBS. They did their futility analysis at 75 patients, but at the same time, they were still operating on more and more patients at different centers. So, you know, whether one center was more successful than the other, hopefully they'll publish their clinical trial data, but there's also a lot of ethical issues and a lot of ethics specialists have questioned the actual quality of that data that has been published already. So just like you in the 70s having to figure out, you know, look through, kind of decipher, you know, how are these outcome studies being conducted, who's sponsoring them, is there a market value? There are many conflicts of interest with the doctors who are involved in the trials. So there are a huge list of ethical issues, just as there was in the 70s. But I think one of the problems, Peter, is I don't think there's a lot of patient advocacy going on of the strength that you had in the 70s.
No, it's much worse now in most ways. See, I could get a lot of media attention to these kinds of issues in the 70s. Now the media has been totally taken over by the manufacturers, especially the drug companies, but that spills over into the shock docs and the psychosurgeons. the system of the media is really closed compared to the 70s and even the 90s. I think it's much, much more closed. But we have all these alternative ways of communicating now, just like you're working with, which I didn't have. Incidentally, this idea about, you know, their controlled clinical trials, what I found is that men and women who do this kind of work almost universally are liars. Well, they couldn't do the work. I mean, there may be an exception here or there. I don't think so, actually, because how could you do the work? What really floored me and caused, really, I mean, it was just, I couldn't integrate into my thinking about life was when I started to investigate the three Harvard people involved, two neurosurgeons, one the head at Boston City, one the head at Harvard, Mass General, and one who was a psychiatrist at the Mass General. And they had written up a case named Thomas R. as this complete success, that he was paranoid before and violent before and destructive before, and now he was perfect after the surgery. Well, his mother heard about me criticizing this project because I'd gone to Boston many times. I had a lot of air time there on radio and TV. Couldn't get that anymore. And the mother got in touch with me, and I met Thomas R., which is his book name, and he was hiding in his mother's house with a pillow over his head to keep the doctors from Mass General from controlling his brain and ruining his brain. And he was just terrified. He was actually under newspapers, not even under a pillow. And he had become violent, and he'd become a person who wandered into emergency rooms around the country. There was no way that William Sweet, Frank Irvin, and Vernon Mark, these three people from Harvard, doctors, could have not known all this story. And back then, I'm not sure what happened today, the Journal of the American Medical Association allowed me to write a long letter on this data in response to their claims. But I just found that they lied again and again. I had a follow-up on four or five of Ballantyne's patients came to me. They were just wrecked by the surgery. There were many suicides that he hadn't mentioned. I mean, you can't trust people who do shock treatment and lobotomy and deep brain stimulation. Go ahead. Let me say one other thing. They also won't do the kinds of research that would actually show how damaging it is. For example, if you ask somebody who's had psychosurgery or is injured by electroshock, first of all, if before you get to shock treatment or before you get to psychosurgery, you ask somebody to write an autobiography, you just say, write me a brief autobiography, a few pages. They'll write about their struggles, their pain and suffering, their issues. If you ask them afterward, they'll write something down like a man in my office did recently. They'll just write down something like, my birthday, my children's birthday, my wife's birthday, that's the autobiography. They just get hardly concrete. They can't conceptualize themselves as human beings. That simple test that was done in a whole range of patients way back in the 40s, just by a fellow named Tao, just made so clear the destruction of the patient. Well, they don't want to actually look at the human being, so they'll try to make up some phony test to test the patient with. I'm going to be quiet again, Danielle, and this brings up such memories to me. I mean, it's just amazing. Please, go on with what you're saying about following these people up.
Well, that was an interesting thing that I experienced as well in 2005. And these things are eerily similar, history repeating itself. The first woman that I interviewed was a 21-year-old woman who was basically pretty much a shut-in after she'd had three psychosurgeries between the age of 17 and 19, and she was able to show me she was an A-plus student, honor roll student before she'd had the surgeries, and she was an artist as well. She did these beautiful drawings, and she presented me with her sketchbook, And after this first surgery, she was able to do these beautiful drawings before the surgery. And after the first surgery, the drawings became almost like cartoon stick figures. And by the time she'd had the second surgery, and again, she's having more surgeries because the first surgery hadn't worked. She's having a repeat surgery. And this is quite common for them to have repeat surgeries. By the third surgery, there was just blank pages. There was really nothing. She had lost all of her ability to artistically render anything, to have any kind of cognitive intelligence. But I think the most striking and horrifying thing to me was she was aware. She was able to remember what she used to be, and she was able to see herself kind of locked into this cage. And her last entry, it was after the second surgery, her last entry in this sketchbook, in this very shaky writing, was, "Start a brain injury support group." So cognitively at that point, she really wanted to reach out and be a part of, she wanted to reach out to other people, and she wanted to stop this from happening, or at least provide somewhere for these people to discuss and get some kind of therapy for their adverse effects. But she was pretty much too far gone. She'd have moments of lucidity, almost like someone with Alzheimer's. But for the most part, she was like a small child once again. And she galvanized me. After I wrote about her, for a women's glossy magazine out of New York called Jane Magazine. She had been a reader of that type of magazine, the kind of magazine that women from 19 to 35 would read. And so she was delighted that her story was being told to her peers that she would never meet in the future. She had no future, technically. And she really galvanized me one of the jobs of being a reporter is to bear witness. And I felt like I had been there to witness and to pass on her story to the rest of the world. And that was a very, I think about her all the time. Every time I research this topic, I sort of channel this girl who has actually since died. I wasn't able to communicate with her through her family because they were very upset that this article had come out and had discussed all the adverse effects. But I kept in touch with her psychiatrist. And a couple of years later, she died, and he couldn't remember how. He said it might have been by suicide. I'm not sure. Might have had to do with the surgery. So I keep her in mind at all times, just as you do with people you met.
Yeah. Do many of these people seem pushed into it by others, or are they just desperate?
I think in many of the PBS cases...
Do you think this girl could have been pushed in by her parents, and that's why they felt negatively about publicity?
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that they're really... their psychiatrists are telling them, you have a medical specialist telling them this is a biological illness, and we can treat it with a biological treatment. So they're comparing it to something like Parkinson's, even though the neurosurgeons will tell me, yeah, I don't see any anomalies in the brain of people with psychiatric illnesses. I target based on my instructions from the psychiatrist or from neurology. So I don't think DBS is going through this sort of issue as much because most of the people in the trials are in their 40s and 50s, and I think there is somewhat careful patient selection versus psychosurgery, which can be done as a one-off procedure. So at least with these clinical trials, they are technically going through an ethics department at a university. You would think there would be many more layers of protection for them. Versus anybody just being able to go talk to a neurosurgeon a psychiatrist saying to a neurosurgeon, I think we can do this procedure. So I think that there are fewer, I haven't read that many articles about young women, but then they are also doing DBS for things like anorexia. DBS is also being used for essential tremor, which happens with children. So there are many ethical issues here.
When you say it's being used, Danielle, what does that mean? Technically, this should always require an institutional review board, all kinds of protections. So if some youngster is getting this for anorexia, is somebody just deciding they're going to use it as a clinical tool without getting all kinds of permissions and safeguards?
Yeah, well, there's currently some research going on at University Western Hospital in Toronto. That's where the first DBS, the first psychiatric DBS
I think that's where I closed the women's lobotomy ward in the 70s.
And you have closed a few wards in Montreal as well, because there was that famous institution in Montreal.
Yeah, I remember it was the Western Institute, and they didn't have a male psychosurgery ward. They only had a female one. And that drew a lot of, I made a lot of attention out of that, and I think they had to close. Wow.
Yeah. Well, they're a little bit more careful. Typically, the trials I see are they're pretty much equal, 50-50, male, female. It's not like electric shock therapy where you have 70 to 80% are women. They're a little bit more careful with those kind of things. But yeah, I mean, it seems that at these centers that did have these kind of procedures, that were doing these procedures in the 60s and 70s, that continues to this day. So you see it at Harvard, Mass General. You see it at these specialty centers in different places. But another aspect of this is also the marketing of it. So you have a neuromodulation device. It's called neuromodulation or neurostimulation modification as a market. So this market is booming. And you have these device manufacturers that are paying big bucks to do these trials, to try to get their device to be used in as many treatments as possible, so that the window opens to, goes from Parkinson's and essential tremor, and it becomes the floodgates open to do other treatments. But I think going back to the individuals who choose to have the procedure done, yes, they're typically professionals. These are the people I've interviewed. These are really smart people to begin with, and they're smart people despite the fact that they've had so many drugs thrown at them. Many of them have had electric shock. They're smart despite all of these treatments that have been done on them, but they're desperate, and they're willing to try anything. And many of them are suicidal. And they think, well, I'll just try this one thing before, as Jim said in my article, I'll try this before I check out. So
many of them
expect that they'll die on the table.
It's almost a form of suicide.
I wanted to say a word
about shock treatment. You describe, and I'd like to ask you some more about the technology. The shock treatment provides, with the two main machines, over 400 volts with a fixed current of 800 or 900 milliamps. So it's up to 800 or 900 times more, but it may only be like 80 times more than what's being used here directly to the tissue. And not all of it gets through the brain, but the attempt is to make it a steady current into the brain. So shock treatment is just pouring it onto the skull and wetting the electrodes and doing everything possible to get all that into the brain. But shock treatment really needs to be seen as a closed head prefrontal lobotomy, along with a lot of other kinds of damage. What size were the cannulas that they use when they put these wires in? How much damage is just the insertion of the wires doing?
It's really hard to tell. I've seen some videos of the wires being pushed through the brain, and I've heard it described simplistically as the brain neurons being pushed to the side. I find that difficult to believe, but they will admit that the procedure itself, neurosurgeons will freely admit that there are micro lesions from the surgery itself and from the DBS device. And the DBS device, the diameter of the contacts is about 2.7 in diameter, 2.7 centimeters. So that's quite big.
Really?
Yeah.
That's like two with the two of your fingers.
Yeah, 2.5 to
2.7. Check it out if you can while we're talking.
Yeah, and so the wire is anywhere from 5.5 millimeters to 1.5. But as I mentioned in the one of the people I interviewed, Steve Ogburn, he had a lot of damage from the wires itself because they push on really important nerves that control movement, and so he had a lot of physiological issues. Other people I interviewed had many psychological issues. Rich had a whole bunch of psychological issues, which made you wonder if his hypothalamus and his amygdala had been stimulated because he had fight or flight kind of reactions. So he had a homicidal rage. He had aggression. All of these things have been documented in Parkinson's patients as well. So it causes many potentially psychological adverse. It changes your mood, but it also causes all of these physiological issues. And really, they haven't done that many studies, post-mortem studies, on people with Parkinson's. So the technology has been available through the FDA for movement disorders since the late 90s. I think for Parkinson's it was 2002. So a lot of people, although many people are walking around with the DBS device for Parkinson's, they haven't been able to do autopsy studies. And when they have done autopsy studies, they've found foreign bodies, and they can't explain where those foreign bodies came from. But they do definitely see a lot of scarring in the brain.
That's really, really important. Wow. Well, I'm going to take a deep breath and ask you what you want to continue with here. I could talk a lot myself, but I think we'll have you back. But I'd like to just hear some more information from you. Do you find that the people who talk to you about the damage done to them, that while they have a perspective on the damage, they can't fully feel their sadness and their despair because of the damage? Or has it not damaged them that much?
Well, the interesting thing with the DBS recipients I've spoken with is they do talk about cognitive issues. But at the same time, and they have a lot of trouble with being able to concentrate, to focus. So they'll have problems with reading, and they'll have problems with multitasking. None of the three people I interviewed have been able to continue working. They're all on disability. The issues have been so strong that they haven't been able to continue doing the work they did before the DBS. But at the same time, these people must have been very bright to begin with, because they are they're very lively, interesting, focused, communicative people who have actually had to do a lot of their own research since they've had the DBS device inserted, or in all three of their cases, they've all had the device explanted, removed from their brains. So they talk to me about their struggles in trying to look at clinical trial data. I mean, one of the reasons you don't see a lot of health reporting on this topic is that it takes a lot of research due diligence to find out about these treatments. So from a perspective as a reporter, it's tough enough to do the research and really dig into the science behind it. So all of these people have been able to do that. I didn't know them before this their surgery, so I can't really comment on that. But they themselves say, yeah, I have cognitive issues. And it becomes very difficult for them to battle in any way against the injustices that have been done to them.
Right.
So you have Steve Ogburn, who is actually pursuing a lawsuit. But as most people know, if you pursue a lawsuit against a large university and a sponsor, a device manufacturer that makes billions of dollars, these people have deep pockets, and it's very hard to have a successful lawsuit. Steve Ogburn's trying, and I commend him for his energy, but it's tough for them. It's tough for them to be able to continually fight, especially when they're still dealing with this debilitating depression. And like Jim said, it's actually, they all said it's depression on steroids. So not only are they dealing with the initial depression, they think that the DBS has actually amped up the depression, and at the same time they're dealing with all of these issues around. You know, I can't imagine how upset they must feel that they've sort of been left behind. Rich had mentioned that after he was explanted, the sponsors cut the ties with him, and he tried to contact specialists that did dealt with brain trauma, and everywhere he looked, doors were just closed. And I found this with all three of the people I interviewed, that once you're a part of an experimental clinical trial, that label stays on your medical file forever, and it becomes very difficult for you to get treatments, even to see a specialist to see what's going on in my brain. So it's quite terrifying from that perspective as well.
That sounds like a combination of covering for your colleagues and being afraid of being asked to testify in a lawsuit. Do you think there's other motives?
Well, one of the motives is obviously money, because some of the doctors that are involved in this research, Dr. Helen Mayberg and Dr. Andres Lozano, the two doctors from the Toronto group, they actually have a licensing patent on DBS for this specific part of the brain, the subgenual cingulate gyrus. So they actually license their patents to the medical device companies, have no idea how much money they make from it, but there's a financial incentive there.
I would think that there's a real serious ethical conflict there. I think these are not Americans. I wonder if this was done in America, if that wouldn't constitute a really serious ethical conflict.
Well, Dr. Mayberg is actually at Emory now. She's working out of Atlanta, and she's doing these clinical trials in Atlanta. She had actually said, when I initially spoke with her, she said, "Yeah, we started this trial in Canada, and we might not have been able to do it in the States at first, in part because our healthcare, the Canadian healthcare, covered the surgery itself, which is about $60,000 for the surgery itself." So she said that allowed us to be able to work with patients in Canada. But once they had that initial data from Canada, they were able to do it in the States. And all of the Broaden trial participants that I interviewed are Americans, and the trial was an American trial. So it's definitely happening. It's able to happen in the U.S. The Broaden trial in the States was sponsored by St. Jude Medical, the device manufacturer. So they provided funding for that. There are other trials underway that Dr. Mayberg has a trial at Emory going on right now that's sponsored by the Dana Foundation. And the Dana Foundation is actually a group that they deal with a lot of neuroethics. So they're helping fund this trial, which surprises me because, I mean, they're as far as I know, they're an organization that specializes in neuroethics.
They're the worst. It was actually the big ethicists who stood more in my way than almost anybody except the surgeons themselves and the psychiatrists. during the 70s and 80s, because they would sort of try to co-opt what I was saying, and they would go on to the, they'd be the ones who would get on the public forums and raise issues. You know, they would just raise issues rather than say, you got to stop this mutilation of people's brains. Now, back in the 70s, it was clear that the neurosurgeons didn't necessarily have an easy time making a living. You'd think there'd be just plenty of regular problems for them to operate on, but there was definitely a glut back in the 70s, and it was a boom to be able to do these relatively quick and easy operations on people and then never see them again. Right now, are neurosurgeons hungry?
Well, I have actually heard from surgeons, from neurosurgeons, saying that they're not very busy. There are only so many organic disorders, only so many people coming in with tumors.
Yeah. They want to be able to operate on the rest of us.
Yeah. This is one of the concerns. And one of the other concerns is that neurosurgery, you learn a lot in med school when you're becoming a neurosurgeon. You learn a lot about the organic disorders. You don't learn about psychiatric disorders. So as neurosurgeons have said to me, they don't really understand psychiatric disorders. That's not their specialty. So they rely heavily on the psychiatrists or the neurologists who come to them. They have to have trust that those doctors, those psychiatrists and neurologists, are informed themselves about potentially about that there are no other treatments for this person. So if a neurosurgeon is faced with sort of an ethical dilemma, it would be a psychiatrist saying, well, this person will probably commit suicide if nothing's done for them. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I mean, the statistical evidence isn't that it's quite rare, even for severe depression. It's about 3.4% who will actually commit suicide. But the neurosurgeons are convinced by the psychiatrist to do this. Because it's kind of a last resort. So you'll have surgeons say, well, these people will die if I don't do something for them. So you could look at it from that perspective as well. But most of the people involved in DBS research are in some way paid by the device manufacturers. So whether it's paid to do talks, whether it's paid to do research, or whether it's through these patent licensing payments, they have been called out for having major conflicts of interest. As far as the ethicists are concerned, I've met some great ones, some great ethicists who say, Francoise Baylis at Dalhousie explained it to me that neuroethicists are necessary now with clinical trials. So they have to be part of the team now. And she said in some ways they've become like journalists who are embedded in war zones.
I don't think so at all. They are not like journalists in war zones. They're like whores on the street. These ethicists, in my experience, are part of the establishment. They never say anything to throw off the establishment. Many of them have professorial kinds of ranks. You don't hold those and suggest that medical people are doing something unethical. You can see the level of respect I have for so-called medical ethicists. In my experience, they've been an impediment to all of the changes that we've tried to make over the decades. I mean, that's not been yours so much, Danielle. By the way, folks, I didn't continue to introduce her. I've gotten too involved in this. We're talking with Danielle Egan, E-G-A-N. Danielle, we got to finish soon here. How do people get in touch with you?
Well, I just joined Twitter, and I have a website. If you go to the Madden America website, and I hope viewers, listeners will read the article, there's a link to my website. and people can read all of my articles about psychiatric neurosurgeries on my website. So I would go through Madden America, and there's a link there to my information.
I had one other question I wanted to get in. We've got only a very few minutes left. When I was looking at the psychosurgery literature in depth, one of the things that appalled me was that all the experimentation was actually done on humans, not on animals first. What's the situation with this deep brain stimulation? Are they implanting larger animals like chimpanzees and letting them live with these devices for 5 years before they do this kind of experimentation?
Well, there has been some animal research, but it's not in the same way that a lot of clinical research is done. So there's ongoing animal research. It's still happening now. One of the problems that researchers would suggest is that you have to do it, human research, but there has been criticism that a lot of these stages have been skipped. So there hasn't been enough animal research before they started doing human trials.
These guys can't wait to get their hands on our brains. They don't want to spend 5 or 10 years or more seeing what happens inside the brain of an animal when the implantation is in there for years, and then you sacrifice the animal and look at the brain. They don't want to see if you can actually see the cognitive deterioration in the animal, and so on and so forth. Oh, we have to experiment on humans. I mean, that is just so unethical. Well, it sounds like not much has changed. I should not elevate my respect for neurosurgeons any higher than it was before, certainly not for psychiatrists or corporations that fund this. And there's a lot of good neurosurgeons out there. I mean, I'm sure the vast majority would never perform these things, but they're not complaining about it either. They're not standing up and saying, we don't want lobotomists in our ranks. Go and do animal research that you can't get paid much for instead of mutilating brains on insurance company money and so on. So
it surprised me. Yeah, it has surprised me, the lack of feedback from the medical community.
And it's always been that way. I was the first medical man to ever stand up publicly on lobotomy. I was the first medical to ever stand up publicly on shock treatment, the first medical to testify in court against a lobotomist, the first one to testify in court, as far as I know, against an electroshock doctor, and if not the first, certainly the first, I think, with psychosurgery. I'm the first one to testify in a winning psychosurgery suit, first one to testify in a winning shock suit. I mean, that's how rare this is.
And there have to be doctors. I mean, there's no one like you, but there have to be doctors and med students right now that may have some of the same interests as you.
Maybe there'll be somebody
and where are they?
By you or me. Maybe this show. Listen, I've got to finish up now. We're talking with Danielle Egan, EGAN, Vancouver, freelance journalist. You can get to her through the Madden America website, and you can locate her through that. Danielle, I want to keep on talking to you about this. We'll communicate with each other about what the latest things are and what you may want to talk about. And you've educated me today, and you've educated a lot of folks, and this will be archived, thank goodness, for the world to read. And for the world to listen to. Hey, keep up your wonderful work, Danielle.